So I guess we can get started. So today I will we will finish the discussion of this table with a few more comments on this table model that will include several. We will start by several computations of the partition function, several Z computations. We already computed it once, but let me remind you how this model, we could compute this partition function in many ways. That's one thing we will do. Then we will recall the expectation value of x squared and the propagator. And we will discuss a bit what we will do with this mu, with this extra term that a priori we did not know how to compute, and something called Feynman graphs, which is a way of studying perturbations around the model that we know how to solve, which is Gaussian, and it gives us some graphical interpretation of how to do it. And along the way, we will discuss some aspects of universality. Once we are done, we'll go to the quantum setup. Because so far we have studied a classical table. So just before we start, let me just clarify. I was puzzled in the last lecture. How could it be that my notebook was working and in the lecture something was not working? So here is, I think the difference is, I did not check, but I was thinking today while driving here. I think the difference is the following. You can check in the video and in the notebook that in the lecture, I put argument t in the variables. And in the notebook, there are no argument t in the variables. So what it means is that when I solve the differential equation in the lecture, I was getting x11, for example, as a function of t is some interpolation function, which depends on t. Okay. Otherwise, in a notebook that you played with, you would get just x11 as a pure function is this function. And it doesn't know what the argument is. Okay? Therefore, when I take some derivative of x11, for Mathematica, this is derivative with respect to the first argument of the function x11 applied to t. So when I make this replacement, Mathematica asks, where is x11 of t? And looks here, and there's no x11 of t. There is x11 derivative applied to t, but there's no pattern x11 of t. So this replacement could not work. But the second one, I look here, x11, I plug this function, I take the derivative, and then I evaluate at t, and it's all good. Okay? So in the lecture, what we were doing is we went here, and we removed t, and then it worked. Okay? But in the notebook that you have, t was not there to start with. And that's why it was better. Okay? But it's just a question of Mathematica syntax. Any question? Okay, so what we did was we considered this classical table. So by the way, I'm just curious. The homework, was it supposed for you to do during this weekend? Or you start this weekend and you have some time to do? You start this weekend and you have
Friday.
This Friday, okay. Did someone start? Did you try some variations? I mean, you had many examples, but I'm just curious, what did you try as a variation?
Different boundary conditions.
Uh-huh. And then the movies are different, right? You have the waves hit the walls. And you, what did you try?
I tried removing some sites and then see how it
worked. And it didn't work, right? It didn't thermalize. If you just remove the sites.
No, I included the x to the fourth contribution.
Ah, okay.
So yeah, it didn't thermalize, just more slowly.
Okay. Did someone else try something else? Yeah, first I tried with zero boundary conditions, but then my energy was not conserved because I probably forgot someone half, so that's why I did periodic boundary conditions. But is your energy perfectly conserved?
I haven't checked.
Okay, yeah, you should check and tell me so that I fix my factor. Okay, good. So what were we doing? We said we have a model where at each side we have some height, x, so this n is a vector. At each side we have an x, l are up left, down right, right? And we have to compute a partition function by integrating over all possible vertical velocities and all possible heights. Okay. And if we go to Fourier modes, when we go to Fourier modes, we get this xk, which is a complex variable, and x conjugate is x minus k. And then here we see that we just get a bunch of decoupled, and that's what's important, oscillators. Whereas here, they look, the in position space, these guys, they look, or they are coupled. Right? We are coupling different degrees of freedom at different sites. That's why we punch the table and everything thermalizes, because we are coupling them. But then eventually, they are just a bunch of decoupled modes. Right? And each of them, we knew how to solve. And this omega square, when we went to Fourier, was just this. And in the notebook, it was 4. Let's just remind why it was 4. Because if you remember, in the equations of motion that we wrote first, there was no factor of 2. So how could there be no factor of 2? Right now, there is a factor of 2, because you see there is k over 2. And when you take derivative with respect to x, the 2 kills the k over 2. But x appears twice for each link, right? At one position and at the neighboring, x appears twice. So in total, there is a factor of 2. So if you want no factor of 2, you need to put extra k over 2 here. Then there is no 2 in the equations of motion, but then here it would be 4 that would appear and not 8. That's the difference between the notebook and the lecture. In the notebook, we have an extra 1/2 here. Okay, good. So let's start by computing this Z in a few ways. Because what was the way, what we did something a bit funny, which is, we wanted to compute a classical partition function, and we went quantum, and then we took the classical limit, which is fine, because you had done the computation of the quantum oscillator, and that's why I took advantage of it. So the way we did it was we said that Z is equal, and this is true even quantum mechanically. We said this is equal to the product over K and Z for each mode K, and this Z was just the sum over N e to the minus beta omega k n plus 1/2, and then we took the limit when this beta was small, so that we take a classical limit. Okay. In this way, we got that the result was just product over k became integral of the sum over k, and then this gave log of 1 over beta omega k square. No, maybe omega k. Beta omega k. Yeah. Right. So this was what we were getting as a result of doing this computation. Okay. So let's see how we could have gotten this directly without going quantum mechanically and then taking a classical limit again. So here we went quantum mechanically, and then here we took a classical limit again. But of course, we could have just computed this integral, which are just a bunch of Gaussian integrals, right? Where we have p and x. So we could have just computed this by doing these Gaussian integrations. And here, I want to open a parenthesis to do some Gaussian integral of the following form. So if I have integral dx e to the minus alpha x square, right? And this guy, everyone knows how to do. I mean, this was in the tutorial, but everyone has seen this. I'm not going to spend too much time, but let's just rescale x by alpha. If I rescale x by square root of alpha, I get 1 over square root of alpha times the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity e to the minus x squared dx, and then this integral is square root of pi. Now, what if I have the integral of dx times, say, x squared e to the minus alpha x squared? Well, this is just minus derivative with respect to alpha, I take derivative with respect to alpha, I bring down the x squared, so I put a minus so that I don't have the minus of the previous results. So derivative with respect to alpha here, it's minus, it gives me an extra minus, so it gives me 1/2 of square root of pi. And therefore, we write that the average of x squared is equal to, sorry, here there is some alpha as well, over alpha to the 3/2. So the average of x squared is 1 over 2 alpha. So it's the inverse of what multiplies x squared with an extra 1/2, right? And that's the average of x squared, right? It's just dividing this integral by that integral there, the ratio of the two integrals. And that's why it's often convenient if we were to divide, if we were to say divide by 2, let's do it in a different color. I divide by 2. It just means that alpha, I put alpha over 2 everywhere, right? It's just defining alpha. Okay. No, sorry. I'll take it back. I don't want to do it like this. I just want to say by words that if alpha was alpha over 2, the propagator would be 1, right? I see here. So this is equal to 1 for alpha equal to 1/2. So that's just the canonical normalization where this average of x squared would be 1. Now, we had something slightly different. For us, we had an integral, right, dx, and then we had e to the minus alpha absolute value of x squared. So this guy is complex. And instead of integrating over the real numbers, we integrate over the complex numbers. Right? Now it depends on the measure. It depends what we mean by dx. Okay, first of all, because it's over the complex numbers, it's better to put a d2x to indicate it's a two-dimensional integration. And now it depends on your definition. If you call this d imaginary, d real, right? You could call this is derivative with respect to real, or if you put a 1/2 there or not, okay, it's up to you. Okay, is it clear? This is just definition of what this means. But let's compute something that is not definition invariant. Let's compute the average. So let's multiply by x squared and divide by the same thing, d to x, e to the minus alpha, absolute value of x squared. Okay. And how would we say this is? Well, I would say this is integral dx dy, where now I'm saying that x is the real part and y is the imaginary part. And then absolute value of x squared is just x squared plus y squared. E to the minus alpha, x squared plus y squared, divided by the integral dx dy, e to the minus alpha, x squared plus y squared. Right? And this would give me, I'll do it now on this side. So the two integrals, x squared and y squared, give the same thing, clearly. So it just gives me twice. So we can drop the y squared term. We have y squared plus x squared. We drop the y squared downstairs, of course. Not in the exponent, right? So downstairs. Downstairs means not in the exponent. So we drop the y squared. We can just put a factor of 2. And then the y integral cancels. It's the same up and down. And the x integral gives me just the y integral just cancels, and the x integral gave me just a 1/2, 1 over 2 alpha. This is from the x integral times 1 from the y integral because it just cancels, and so this is just 1 over alpha. Okay? Do you agree? Anyway, so this is just the integration, and I just want to point out what would happen if instead of absolute value of x squared here, if we would replace this by x squared. Now, x squared, what would happen, right? X squared So this is what we get. Now, if we replace absolute value of x squared by just x squared is real part square plus twice real imaginary times I minus imaginary part square. Do you agree? And now you see that what happens is that this term is zero because it becomes integral of the real part and of the imaginary part, and by parity it's zero, right? Because the real part is even, you multiply by real, it's odd, it's zero. The integral over imaginary part also gives zero. So this integral would give zero here just by symmetry. And similarly, by symmetry, these two terms contribute the same, and because there is a minus sign, it would also give zero. So this is just a fancy way of saying that x squared, integral over x squared, should be zero, because for each x, there is another x, which is I times x, which gives minus itself. So when I integrate over complex values, it's the analog of integrating over an odd function. An odd function integrated over the real numbers gives zero, because for each x, there is a minus x. Right? And so it cancels because the function is odd. If I integrate over the complex numbers x squared times a function, e to the minus absolute value, for each x, there is an ix, which the integrand gives minus itself. So the result ought to give zero. Right? Whereas when it's absolute value, it doesn't, and it just gives something simple that we can compute. So that's, someone asked me at some point in the derivation, we add this, we add the computation of the expectation value of xk, xk prime, if you remember. And we said that xk, xk prime was k prime needed to be equal to minus k, right? And not to plus k, right? Plus k would be this computation here. It would be, we would compute expectation value of xk squared. We don't want xk squared, we want absolute value of xk squared. Xk squared is just zero. Because for each xk, there is ixk, which cancels itself, right? So that's where this minus, this important minus was coming from. And therefore, this was equal to this times the expectation value square of xk, right? Okay, but what's important is written here for now, that we want to compute the partition function. So this side remark explains, in the fact that it just, that the integral is just the same as usual Gaussian integration, right? That gives this square root of alpha down here, right? And therefore, what do we have? We have here a bunch of Gaussian integrals. Each of them, I would read off the corresponding alpha, which is this and this, right? Times beta, of course. This. And we are just, sorry. So these prefactors here is exactly this alpha here that we have here. So we just can do directly the Gaussian integration. So we do the Gaussian integration, and we will get just the product over k. And from the momentum, we would get some 1 over square root of alpha. So square root of 2m. Over beta, and from the positions we would get product of k, 1 over square root of alpha, so square root of 2 over m beta omega k square, and therefore the 2 and the m cancel, and we get that this is just product over k of 1 over beta omega k. Right, which is exactly the same as we get here. Right, this is just the result of doing usual Gaussian integration. Clear?
Are there some factors of 2pi?
Ah, yeah, good point, yeah. There would be some factors of pi, right? So there would be some pi's times this. These pi's are just normalization. So whenever we compute averages and we make something over z, these pi's would just cancel. But very good point indeed. There are some pi's. These pi's, some power, it's also, we were also not very careful. Is it dp or dp over 2pi h bar, for example, here? So all these overall constants, we don't care. We care not on the dependence on pi's, but on the dependence on beta, m, on physical parameters, because those will give different physical results. But indeed, there will be some pi's that we were not very careful about. Let me just comment quickly, because I think you have seen this in one of your courses, so let me just maybe remind you. I'll actually do it up there. Any question? Let me just remind you on the several Z computations that there is one more. We could do a quantum path integral. So we did a classical path integral, that's the Gaussian integration. We did a quantum, if you want, canonical computation, that's the explicit sum. And we could do a quantum path integral. Okay, and what's the difference between a classical path integral and a quantum path integral? So in the classical path integral, I just treat p and x as if they were independent, right? And I just say I have velocity and a position. But quantum mechanically, you studied the harmonic oscillator in my test course by path integral, right? Where you were told that you should sum over trajectories, right? E to the minus beta times a Lagrangian, where you replace p by x dot. So what would we have to do? So let's do the quantum path integral for a given mode k. What would this be? Let me remind you. It would be like this. I would say that zk is equal, I integrate over all trajectories x with the condition that x of 0 is equal to x of beta, trajectories that are periodic because I take the trace of e to the minus beta h, and that translates into periodicity of e to the minus the integral d tau. So this, I'm assuming, because I've seen more or less the note, so I'm assuming this is a reminder from my test course. But please tell me if I'm wrong. E to the minus this this integral here, where we have the Lagrangian for x dot and x, where this Lagrangian would be m x dot square over 2 plus m omega k square over 2 x square. We integrate over x. I don't need the index k. It is just the integration variable. Okay. Right. And now, what would be the next step? We would say, well, I'll write a basis of functions that are periodic in time. So I just say here that my x of tau is equal to a Fourier transform now in time with some coefficients. Let's call them c, j, e to the I omega j times tau. Okay, omega j might be a bad name because we already have an omega k here. So let's call capital small omega j, where this small omega j would be 2 pi over beta times an integer j. So this j would be any integer. So for example, if j is 0, it's just a constant. A constant is a periodic function.
Even the board a bit, because people cannot see.
Sorry, yeah, good point. Good point, right? So we have x is periodic, so I write a decomposition of x of tau as a summation of subconstants, and then a periodic function of tau. So this omega is 2 pi over beta, so that it's periodic in beta. And j is an integer. For example, j0 is a constant, j1 is the first mode, j2 is the second mode. Right? And then what happens when I take the derivative? When I take the derivative, this omega, so then the Lagrangian evaluated on this solution, right? The Lagrangian would become equal to, well, so the integration over time would be integral d tau from 0 to beta. I plug there x squared in the Lagrangian. So from the point of view of exponentials, I would get, write like this. Let's write everything. Sum over j and j prime. It's quadratic. So for each x, I replace the corresponding sum. I would have cj, cj prime, e to the I omega j tau plus I omega j prime tau. That's one exponential from x, from one x, one other exponential from the other x. And then the last term first, because it's trivial, it is just m omega k squared over 2. And the one from the x dot will give plus m omega j squared over 2. With a minus, but on the other hand, probably I actually have a wrong minus there, right? Because it's the Lagrangian. Yeah, probably there is a, okay.
You said we rotate it?
Yes.
Sorry? Yeah, we weak rotated it. There would be a minus. Okay? There is a minus somewhere, but there is a relative minus coming from this x dot being of tau. And then this would be the computation. And now what happens? So now this integration, this is an integer, so the same business as before. This integral projects into j equal minus j prime. Otherwise, the integration would give me a 0. And when j is equal to minus j prime, it just gives beta. And therefore, we would get that this Lagrangian will be sum over j. J prime is minus j. There is a beta outside. And then we have integral of cj, for the same reason cj star is complex conjugate. And then actually I did it a bit fast. Here it would be already omega j prime. Sorry. And there would be I, and therefore actually there would be a minus, and then when we set omega j equal omega j prime, the minus cancels. I'm sorry. M over 2 omega k squared, which is a constant, plus omega j squared.
Why do you still have the integral sign?
I don't. Good, thanks.
Can I also ask another question?
No, yeah.
How come you can have this decomposition for the x of tau in the first place?
So this is just a decomposition of periodic functions, right? My function is periodic. I'm just decomposing functions which are periodic from 0 to beta.
Okay.
Right? So functions that are defined in a circle, and this is the basis of functions defined in a circle. Right? It's functions that are periodic in time. Right? Is it clear? It's like cosines and sines. It's the same story as with the Fourier modes.
So that Then would your path integral like become an integral over the CJ?
Very exactly, yeah. And then this path integral, this here, just becomes the usual integral over the CJs. Because integrating over all functions now is just integrating over all constants. Right? And now, for each CJ, we have a Gaussian integral. Right? So now, we are in business because we have Gaussian for each CJ. Right? So for each CJ, it's just Gaussian. So we can just do it. So therefore, Z would be equal to now a product over J. For each J, they are all independent. And I just write 1 over square root of alpha, which is square root, right, of the inverse of this business. So 1 over omega J square plus omega K square up to some constants, but the constants are not important. What I want to emphasize is that for each j, I get just this product, right, of 1 over square root of alpha, right, and alpha is that prefactor. Let me even put the square root here outside. Okay. And what is this telling us? Remember that this omega j is linear in j, right? Omega j is linear in j. So this is a what is this as a function of omega k? This is the square root of a function of omega k with poles at omega k equal to 2 pi over beta times I times j, where I is square root of minus 1, the usual thing. So it's a function, right, which has poles at all the integers, all the imaginary integers, right? At all the imaginary integers with this spacing, it has poles. And this is just a known function that is just 1 over a sine or an hyperbolic sine. So that's the function which has poles at all the integers. And indeed, this is just a product representation. If we were careful with all the factors, this would be just, therefore, square root of 1 over sinh. Right? Let's write a function which has a function of omega k as these poles. So what would I write? I would write 1 over sinh of omega k times beta this looks good to me. Over to and that is exactly what the computation had done. Remember that this is just a square root of 1 divided by, so if I write the sinh as, if I write it like this, 1 minus e to the minus beta omega k. Here I have to put e to the minus beta omega k over 2, right? And this, you see, is just the ground state energy of the oscillator. And this sum is just what the sum over n gave. Right? So this was just what we had done when we did it fully quantum mechanically. We had landed on this expression here. Okay? So that's just to remind you how the usual path integral would go. Okay? But anyway, this parenthesis that should be read like this in the black part. Starts here, goes here, goes here, goes here. Was just a parenthesis. I think probably you have seen this in quantum mechanics, right? Good. So. So that's what one thing we wanted to do, to make just some comments on the computation of Z. Because indeed, it's a simple Gaussian integral. We can do it in any of our favorite ways. And now I would like to continue making a few more comments. So on the average of x squared, we already made some comments, but let's delve further on this point and say that we have here the expectation value of xn, xn plus m, right? And this was equal to 1 over L square sum over k e to the minus I k m, where m is the separation, divided by omega square plus 8 kappa over m sine square of kx over 2 plus sine square of ky over 2. Okay. Good. So first, let's notice something. That this result here is exact for any lattice L, but it becomes approximately equal when L becomes very large. Right? I can say that this is just the integral d2k over 2 pi square e to the minus I k dot m over omega square plus the same integral where this is over kx in the Brillouin zone and same for ky. And here all I've done is replace this sum by an integral. If you remember, this k went from minus pi over 2 to pi over 2 in steps of 1 over L. So it's very good to replace it by an integral when L is large. Right? Do you agree? It went from minus pi to pi, okay, in steps of 1 over L. Minus pi to pi in steps of 1 over L. So it becomes an integral from minus pi to pi. So when the absolute value is smaller than pi. Okay, and now clearly we see that there are two kinds of natural m's we could consider. So now here with m, we could ask, of course, for two different questions. One is when this m is small, order 1, and the other is when m is order L, when we have like L over 10. We have a big material and we consider faraway points, or when we consider very short distance points. And our idea here should be that here, this lattice matters. Right? We are studying the correlation between a few atoms, like 10 atoms. Of course, the lattice will matter if it's triangular lattice, quadratic lattice, what kind of microscopic details. And here, this should be macroscopic. And so the details should be washed out. And we should not really care about all the details of the table, but rather of only some smaller parameters. Okay? So I would like to remind you how this works, or to show you how it works. But let's just see what further approximation can we do when m is of order L. You see that when m is of order L, this here, this now is when m is of order L, So if M is of order 1, we stop here. Okay? But if M is of order L, we can do one more step. When M is of order L, we see that this function oscillates like crazy, right? M is huge, and we are integrating a function that is oscillating insanely. So it just gives 0, right? The function just wants to kill it. Unless, so what should be the domain of K when M is very large to suppress these oscillations? What's the important domain in K? 0, very small K, right? So the only K that matters is K. So here, the momenta K is of order of 1 over the separation. Okay, that's what we expect, right? Momenta is the inverse of the separation. And therefore, this K is very small, right? And what we can do here is say that this becomes the integral d2k over 2 pi square e to the minus I k dot m. K is of order 1 over m, so now this product is finite. But what we can simplify is down here, the signs, I can expand them out. And I get plus twice kappa over m kx square plus ky square. Right? Because the moments are very small. Okay? And here there's already something cute happening, right? So here we see that we have emergence of rotation symmetry. Rotation symmetry emerged here. So now here we see that at long distances, what is appearing here is the absolute value of k square, right? And therefore, here, this integral is just a function of the distance, right? If I go to radial coordinates, I see explicitly that now it only depends on the distance. Which is definitely not true here, because the lattice was a square lattice. So it's different to go along the diagonal or to go horizontally. You really see the difference. But now, here, things are just invariant under rotation. I can go to polar coordinates and write this explicitly as a function of just the separation. Okay? And all that matters is this term here, right? And of course, the ratio of this term to this term, but this term here, which came from the expansion of the sine square. Okay? So rotation symmetry emerges. And that's, of course, the usual idea that if I have a lattice, right, and if I see from very far away, right, and I draw an approximate circle, I don't see really a square symmetry, but I see that the circle is well approximated. There are many points. So there is an approximate rotational symmetry because now I have many, many points and I don't see a square structure. I have just a discretization of the circle. Okay? So now let's think a little bit more about this in some detail. So let's suppose so if you remember this factor of sine square of kx over 2 plus sine square of ky over 2, right, times 2 square, right, so there is this, right, times 2 square, times 2, this is this 8. Let me remind you where it came from. It came from simply, this was just the summation over the neighbors L, right? Where L now were these neighbors, right? For a given point, I have these neighbors. And then in my computation, I add e to the I k dot L minus 1. Sorry, not exactly like this. Yeah, times e to the minus I k dot L minus 1. And because, so this I can write immediately as summation over L of 2, no, of 4 sine square of k dot L over 2. And then from here to here, it is just specializing to L equal up, down, and down, up. But up to this point here, where I wrote this line, I did not say that what were the neighbors L. Up to this point, the derivation would have been the same for all points. So we could have, for example, right? Imagine we had these neighbors. We said, no, I want the next to nearest neighbors, right? For example, this, right? I would add this. So then what would happen? I would have, say, this term times, what was the constant here? It was kappa over m. And then let me do it in green. What would appear is plus, if there is a new constant kappa prime that would couple this guy with this guy, right? I just add an extra term kappa prime with a slightly larger range. I would get kappa prime over m times the same factor 8. But now the only difference is that here, sine squared, the steps are 2. And I would get kx squared plus sine squared of ky. Right? The only difference, and now the step is twice. And I could also have, instead, I could have, say, chosen these neighbors. I could have chosen these neighbors here. And I would have, therefore, plus kappa prime prime over m times some expression coming from the summation of these neighbors, which is in fact what you are asked in the homework to add these extra neighbors. Now, what will happen with all these terms when we consider now the large separation, m very large, which means that we should expand this with momentum very small. Because notice that right, the only thing that would change in my propagator is that my propagator now, I will just write this integral d2k e to the minus I km omega square plus this thing now, right? The new term, if I add more terms, it's not just this one. Now I have a bunch of other terms. But all these terms, you see, when k is very small, are just going to give me, let me call it like this, m effective square times kx square plus ky square. And you see that right away that's true, because when k is equal to 0, I get 0 by definition. And the function is even, because I'm summing over signs. So if I do a Taylor expansion, it starts with kx squared plus ky squared. And then there are higher order terms. So I don't need to compute explicitly to see that. I can do it right away here. I see it's an even function. It starts with 0, because when k is 0, it's 0. And therefore, it starts with kx squared plus ky squared. Right? So it's equal to this plus other terms that we could call nonlinearities. Or higher, higher case. Right? So you see that, however, for large distances, they would be irrelevant. All we would care is about this constant, right? So this constant here, this m effective. Actually, I don't want to define it as m effective for reasons that are going to. Do I want to define it as m effective? Okay, I'm not sure what I want to define it as. So let me call it kappa effective. Sorry, because it was a kappa before. So kappa effective. This is all we care from the lattice, right? So if I am at large distances, there are many discretizations, many lattice models. And all I care about, if I want to study the large distance behavior, is about this kappa effective. And this kappa effective gets contributions from this k prime, k prime prime, k prime, from the various terms I would have in the lattice. So microscopically, of course, it receives contributions from many. But if I want to study, sorry, without square, so to match the notation there. So if I want to, let me put square, sorry. Sorry for the mess. If I want to study what happens with the propagator, all I have to do is compute the contribution with this kappa square there. Right? I just take this kappa square and replace this thing by kappa square. And that's all the large distance behavior cares about. So at large distance, all these details of which neighbors interact with which ones and so on, all I care is a single constant. That's the notion of universality. Many lattices seen from far away would give the same continuum limits, same long distance physics. Okay? So this is all we care from the lattice, and that's very much related to this notion, as I said, of universality. And now let's see what would we get then at large distances. Let's compute the expectation value, what would happen at large distances. So then, this is all we care. And as we said, the propagator now, the distance between xn and xn plus m, right, would be equal to an integral d2k over 2 pi square, right? And then e to the minus I k dot m over omega square divided, okay, plus kappa effective square times k square. And now this m is huge. K is of order 1 over m. What happens if I integrate when k is pi over 3, say? Right? Pi over 3 is inside minus pi pi. When k is close to pi over 3, it's totally zero, right? I'm integrating a crazily oscillating function close to some value of order 1. All that matters, after all, we know is the origin. It's close to k equals 0. So here, without any problem, we can say that the integration is from minus infinity to plus infinity. I mean, the fact that it should be original from minus pi to pi, but those borders were already super irrelevant anyway, because the function is oscillating like crazy. So we can even extend it to the full plane right now, right? So here, in doing so, is because, in any case, only k is very small matter. Otherwise, this is super oscillating, and it kills it. So when k is of order 2 pi, it's oscillating like crazy, it doesn't matter. Good. Now, let's try to compute further this object. So this can be computed explicitly. It's some Bessel functions, but we don't care about the explicit computation. We want to extract its asymptotic behavior. So let m be equal to some distance r times, say, 1, 0, for example. And we do it without loss of generality, because we can always call this direction, the direction where m is pointing, we can call it direction 1, because we already established that there was rotation invariance, right? This object is invariant under rotation. And therefore, our propagator is equal to the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity dkx over 2 pi, the integral dky over 2 pi e to the I kx r divided by ky square plus kx square plus omega square divided by kappa effective square, and I have to factor out some kappa effective, so some constant here, it doesn't matter, it's just some constant, in order to write it like this. So the integral over ky is now straightforward, because from the point of view of ky, this is just something positive. So I integrate over ky, and I have a pole here, and a pole here. And I just close and pick the pole, right? When ky is I times this quantity, right? So this would give me just integral dkx over 2 pi e to the I kx r divided by the residue, which would be something like square root of omega square over k effective square plus kx square, right? So I write ky plus I this, ky minus I this, and I take the residue. Is it clear? And now I'm integrating over kx, and let's call this m square effective, where m, I think of this as a mass, for reasons that will become clear now. Now what's this integration here? Now I'm integrating, this is in the plane ky, and now in the plane kx, I now have a point kx equal im. This is the point I m effective, and this is the point minus I m effective, and I have a square root cut that starts like this and goes like that, right? When the momentum kx is I times a value bigger than this, inside the square root I get a negative value, right? When kx is I times times this, I get zero, right? But when it's I times something bigger, I get negative value, so that's why I put the square root like this. And now I'm integrating like this, right? So I can again deform the contour, but now the deformation encircles the cut. Okay. So what do we get? We get actually both sides of, okay. We get the integral from I m effective until I infinity, where by this I mean this contour let me write like, it's the integral d psi over 2 pi. I changed variable and I'm going to explain what this variable is. E to the minus m effective r e to the I psi r 1 over square root of psi plus 2i. I'm just doing a shift. So here I'm just doing a shift where I say that kx is I m effective plus psi. And then this contour in psi that I integrate, it's just a contour that does like this around the point zero, right? because kx does like this around the point IMF. Right? And here I get M factor. And what matters is that in this way, I isolate the behavior at large radius, which comes from the first singularity in the complex plane, which is this vicinity of this point here. That's the leading behavior. And that gave me an explicit factor that I can just take out. And then the remaining integral would give me some correction that will address this. Okay? And therefore, this integral would behave as e to the minus this mass effective times the distance. Therefore, it would decay away from the, as we separate the distance, which was the kind of plot we were seeing yesterday, right? You remember the other day, we had a table and we were studying the propagator and we were getting this shape that was decaying away from the origin. And it decays with this exponential factor. So all the details of the lattice end up telling me what this effective mass. You see, now we call it an effective mass because we say that it's the effective length scale, right? So I could call it also 1 over the correlation length, which means that when R, and therefore this letter was terrible, okay? This xi has nothing to do with this xi. This xi is correlation length. And this is integration variable. Forget about it. Don't use xi here. Use something else. But what's the point is that when r is of order xi, this is of order 1, and it decays. And this tells me what's the effective length scale, which you can translate to an effective mass. Right? A particle of mass m has an effective length, which is 1 over the mass. So the point is that in the table, the two excitations far away will decay with some m, which is the mass of the effective excitations. And that mass is the only parameter that comes from the lattice at large distances. Everything else is indeed washed out, and we don't care about the details when we look at very far away. Okay? And indeed, so that's the realization of this expectation. But of course, this thing here would care a computation at this level, which was totally exact what we did. If you plug a different lattice, we would change here. So we would change this for different lattices, right? We would modify this part trivially. And this, of course, would matter very much so for m's of order 1, because then we are exploring lattice sites. We are asked what's the correlation between various sites, and it matters how many sites are coupled. However, when m is very large, not so much so, the only thing that matters is through this single parameter, which tells me what the effective mass is at large distances. Now, if you remember, we had this propagator, right? And we computed this. And this height here, if you remember from the lecture, was small. And this was something like 0.05 in the lecture. So this absolute value of x squared for the parameters that we hit the table was some small number. So the average, so this height, which is related to the expectation value of x mer, was small for us. Which is fine. We hit the table. We did not break the table. Just small thermalization. And therefore, I want to point something out, which is that we could add this term omega square m over 2 x square versus the non-linearity, which was something like mu over 4 x to the 4. And if you remember, we had said m equal 1, omega equal 1. Am I right? Was this what we said in the lecture? Yeah, I think this was true. And we had said mu equal 5, say, right? Okay, good. So mu equal 5 looks like this term is something big. It doesn't look like a small perturbation, right? But you see that because x is very small, because x is small, if you want to see the natural terms, what's natural is to say that x is some square root of 0.05 times y, if you want y to be a function of order 1, right? Because then the expectation value of y square would be just 1. Right, I just rescale x by square root of 0.05, right? And therefore, because x has this natural size, what we are comparing here is 1 versus 1 because, or 1 half, right? 1 half, all these things are 1, and we would compare this 1 half. I factor out this number square for comparison versus 5 quarters times 0.05. Okay. And indeed, this is much smaller. So we have to be careful that depending on which variables you use in your path integral, you might not recognize some terms as a small perturbation. And you might think that it would be very wrong to treat mu as a small perturbation. But we see that it is. And indeed, if you remember, we had seen this, because when we were seeing the thermalization, if you remember the average energy per site, it was something like, okay, let's see in the box. So let's say we had a top corner. Remember what happened? We hit the top corner, so it was very energetic, and then it stabilized, and then we decreased mu, and it decreased a little bit. And this thing was small. It really was much smaller than the average height, right? So we were seeing that indeed turning off mu was not some huge effect, right? So this is when it thermalizes. And here was when we turn off mu, and it was not a huge change. And if mu was supposed to be a huge perturbation, when we turn it off, we should see something very huge. Okay. So then, let's understand what we could do treating mu as a small parameter. So it means that we can treat mu. So this idea is that the idea is that perhaps we can treat mu as a small perturbation. Okay. So here, and this is where what will lead us to the constant of Feynman graphs. That you probably, maybe you have started seeing in QFT. Did you? Not yet. Okay. So the first thing I showed we could try to get some intuition is the following. So remember that this x is beautiful in n space, right? In n space, it's totally nice. But in momentum space, this x will couple various momenta, right? I write x to the 4 as x times x times x times x. Each x is a sum of momentum. All we know is that the total momentum must be 0, but we couple all possible momenta, right? So we are dealing here with something that in the language of oscillators, with in momentum space, which was the nice one where they all decoupled, this is a term that couples, right? This guy couples the various case. And that's crucial. That's why it thermalizes. Because if it was not for this term, I started with some random distribution of case, right? And how does the distribution evolve in time? Each oscillator k just rotates independently, so the distribution doesn't change with time. It's the fact that they couple that allows us to transfer energy from the long frequency modes to the small frequency modes and to the even longer frequency modes, so that all the modes become excited and given by a thermal distribution. Right? If not, it's again, like if you have two systems that are decoupled, they cannot thermalize, right? You just separate them. This is at some temperature, it's at some other temperature. They don't talk to each other, they don't thermalize. They stay independent, right? We need to couple them if we want them to become thermal. The various Fourier modes are also all decoupled. So unless we coupled in some way, they cannot start talking to each other and the system cannot thermalize. So this guy is crucial to couple the modes. Now, because it's coupling the modes, it's a good idea to start with two independent modes that are coupled by some small parameter. So the toy model I want to play with, let's start with this toy model, which would be, we would have two modes. So I would have integral dx1, integral dx2, e to the minus alpha over 2 times x1 squared plus x2 squared. This would be two independent modes. And then we would couple them. So we would say minus mu x1 squared x2 squared. And now they are coupled. And this mu, we think of this as a small perturbation. Okay. So this would be a toy model for understanding a little bit the effect of mu, where I have here, I start with two decoupled modes that I couple in a simple way. So at this moment, I need to make sure that did everyone do the Gaussian part of the tutorial, or does everyone know how it would be done? So let me just, for example, remind you. So I'm just a little bit curious about the following. So when you have integral, say dx1, dxn, x, I1, x, ik, e to the minus 1 half, x, dot a, dot x, where a now is a matrix, an n by n matrix. And the x is an n vector. So did everyone know how to compute this? Right. Who knows how to compute this? Because this was in the tutorial, right? So who knows how to compute this? No, I cannot believe. No, more people know. So should I remember, should I remind people how this is computed, or was it in the tutorial and it's straightforward? If someone, just tell, because it's kind of important. This is the basic, this is a Gaussian integral. You see? In the case we had there, so in our toy model, right? We have a, which would be just 1, 1, or alpha, alpha. And it would be n equals 2. And with a equal alpha, alpha, this would become just the exponent would become alpha over 2 x1 squared plus alpha over 2 x2 squared. Okay. So this, in our toy model, this would be A for us, just a diagonal matrix. But in general, we could have this more general setup. Okay. So there are many ways for doing these integrals. I think maybe it's, since it's so important, I'll sketch it very quickly. So one way we could compute this integral is by adding a source J dot x. And we could notice that this integral is just, I take derivative with respect to the source J I1, derivative with respect to the source J ik, because when taking these derivatives, I will bring down x1, xi1 up to xik, right, of the partition function, where now I have this current j, right, where this would be just the integral dx1 dxn e to the minus 1 half xxx plus j dot x. And I take these derivatives, and after I take the derivatives, I set j equals 0. So j was used just to take the derivatives, and then I put it to 0. But then I can write this exponential as e to the minus 1 half x minus the inverse of a times j a x minus the inverse of a times j. Let's see how this works so far. So the terms x with x are working. The terms, so here it will be j a minus 1 because it's the transpose. So it look like this. So if I add and subtract this term, so let me try to see. So xa, that term works. And then I add a with minus, with an extra minus, a cancels a. I get x dot j. From here I get x dot j. So this gives this, the cross term. But I have one term too much that I did not have before, which was a minus 1 with a minus 1 cancels, but I get a minus 1 minus, minus, minus. So I get plus 1 half j dot a minus 1 dot j. Here it is just I added and subtracted the terms to complete the square. Right? And now, this variable, I could call this y. This is y transpose. And then the integration over y, whatever it gives, it's just a Gaussian integration. It gives just the product of the square root of the eigenvalues of a if I diagonalize a. But what matters is this. So this becomes some constant that doesn't depend on j because I integrate over y. So it becomes just the derivatives with respect to j I1, derivatives with respect to j I k of this exponential here, e to the 1 half j a minus 1 j with j equals 0. So we see that because we take derivatives, we need to take an even number of derivatives. Otherwise, we will get a j downstairs that when we set j equals 0 would be 0. So we see right away that this result is equal to 0 if k is odd. Right? And what if k is even? If k is even, so let's do two derivatives first. When you have two derivatives, I bring down first derivative x on the exponent and gives a minus 1 times j. And second derivative better act on the prefactor because otherwise there is a j downstairs that will give 0 and therefore needs to give a minus 1. Right? So with two derivatives, I would get a minus 1. With more derivatives, when I have four derivatives, I have four of them. Two, one brings down the exponent. Another will bring down another exponent. And the remaining two derivatives must act on the prefactor. Otherwise, I'm not going to get 0 and j equal to 0. Right? So in total, what do I get? I get a sum over all possible pairs. And then I get a minus 1 ij over the product. So let me write that a bit more explicitly. For example, for k equals 4, I will get a minus 1, 1, 2. A minus 1, sorry. A minus 1. I1, I2, A minus 1, I3, I4, plus A minus 1, I1, I3, A minus 1, I2, I4, plus A minus 1, I1, I4, A minus 1, I2, I3. And in general, if K is 6, you see you get more terms, all possible pairs. And how could you draw this computation? You could say that I have four x's. I have x, i1, x, i2, x, i3, and x, i4. And we said that this expectation value was equal to, I say that it's this a minus 1 times this, but this a minus 1, i1, i2, is nothing but the average of two of them, right? If it was just two, this would be the average. So we have the average of two times the average of the other two. So this is 1, 2, this is 3, 4, plus the other case, plus this other case, where we'll just draw all ways of connecting these points, all possible pairs. And this, if you want, would be an example of a Feynman graph. So we would associate this computation to this particular graph, where 1 couples to 2, 3 to 4, 1 to 3, 2 to 4. Okay, so we can think of what is here as an example of, let's put in quotation marks, even though, I mean, it's okay. It's just an example of a Feynman graph. It's just a way of graphically drawing this. So is this clear? I don't want to go too fast. I went fast, but it's because I'm assuming that you knew this already. I'm just reminding the notation. But I'm more than happy to, I'm hoping, is this clear? Here, I'm not going too fast, right? Okay, good. So we see that these propagators, they have this simple graphical interpretation. They're just connecting the two points. And now we could easily see what's the effect of this perturbation mu in my toy model. So now I could say that this, right, this thing here is equal to the expectation. So let's compute the partition function with mu divided by the partition function with mu equals 0. Well, when I expand in mu, I would get expectation value of 1 plus mu expectation value, or minus mu expectation value of x1 square x2 square plus mu square over 2 expectation value of x1 to the 4 x2 to the 4 plus dot 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 as I expand in mu. And this would be the leading correction to coupling both modes. And this, of course, is just equal to 1.
Could you just move the board up a bit again?
Sorry. Yeah. Good point. Ah, no, I cannot. This is stuck. What can I do? Oh my god. Okay. So I will write it somewhere else. Let's write it here. Right? So what I wrote there was that the partition function for my toy model with mu over the partition function with mu equals 0 is just 1 plus or minus mu expectation value of x1 square x2 square plus mu square over 2 expectation value of x1 to the 4 x2 to the 4 plus dot dot dot, where this term here is the leading correction. So let's see, how would we now think of this correction? So we would think like this. So we have x1 square, x2 square. So let's draw two guys like this for particles of type 1, and two things like this for particles of type 2. Yeah, why not? Do I want to do it like this? Maybe. Yeah, before doing so, let me just note that this graph, there is another representation I could use for this graph. I drew this picture. I could also draw a picture like this, where I say that I have an object which has four axes getting out, I1, I2, I3, I4. And the same graphical notation will now say that this is equal to, I connect leg 1 and 2, I connect leg 3 and 4, or I connect leg 1 and 3, I collect leg 2 and 4, or I connect leg 1 and 4, and then I collect leg 1 and 3. So this graphical representation is just the same as another way of representing this, and this is the correct equation, right? So that's the equation, and those are just graphical ways of drawing. And we kind of like this here, this would be a way of representing something that looks like vacuum diagrams. It would be like in quantum field theory, you will see that if you want to compute vacuum diagrams, what you do is you sum over all possible diagrams of particles, particle-antiparticle pairs that are created, annihilate, and so on. So we start with nothing, there are some bubbles, and then there's nothing. That's exactly what we have here. Start with nothing, there's some particle-antiparticle, they create, they annihilate, they create, they annihilate, and then there's nothing. Okay, so in that sense, these are graphs that don't have any open indices, they are just bubble diagrams. Okay, or vacuum diagrams. But these are just names. Vacuum diagrams or bubble. Yeah, vacuum diagrams. So when I draw this, I could draw this, where or I could use some notation to indicate that I have particles of type 1, and here say particles of type 2, so I draw another type of line. So this would be two different notations to represent this picture here, and I would say I want to compute this expectation value or this expectation value. And now I apply the general framework, but now what do I see? I see that 1 and 2 are two decoupled modes, so I have the following propagators. I say that 1 with 1, this expectation value is equal to 1 over alpha. You agree? Because it's the element of the matrix. My matrix is diagonal. The inverse of my matrix is just 1 over alpha. So this is just 1 over alpha. The propagator between this point, the expectation value of this point and this point, is 1 over alpha. But the propagator between the type 1 and the type 2 is equal to 0. because the inverse has no off-diagonal elements. So the inverse with elements which are not diagonal is just equal to zero. Right? So this thing here would be, in the language of Feynman graphs, what we call Feynman rules. Feynman rules. It's a bunch of rules for the propagators, a bunch of graphical rules that says that white propagates to white, black to black, but white to black is equal to zero. Okay? And therefore, when we compose this, there is only this graph and this graph, because all other pairs give zero. Or in this language, if I have this graph, there is only this vacuum diagram where I have a particle antiparticle of type 2, an elate particle antiparticle of type 1. So don't be fooled by this language that I'm using to try to familiarize you with this Feynman graphs and vacuum and so on. We are just computing some Gaussian integrals with two variables, right? So there's nothing too mystic about it. I mean, it is. But this is just a graphical representation that would immediately tell me how to draw other corrections. So now I want to go to this graph here, for example, right? And to this graph, I could think that I have now So let me think. So then to compute these graphs, I could draw it like this if I wanted. I could say that I have x square square square. That was the origin of this, right? It was the square of two terms like that. This is just my choice of how to draw. Yes?
Sorry, could you explain again they're both 1 over alpha. You just wrote 1
over alpha. Yeah. Alpha minus 1 and 1 over alpha. This is both the same thing. Yeah. I don't know. Why did I write alpha minus 1? Both. Okay. 1 over alpha. Okay. Yeah, exactly. They are both 1 over alpha. And now, if I were to lower twice to compute this x square square, let me draw it like this. Let me say that this is x1 square, x2 square, everything square. So it's two of this object. So I draw as two vertices. So we call this a vertex. And now I draw it as two vertices. And I start drawing all the possible propagators. So what propagators could I have? This guy could talk to this guy. And this guy then to this guy. There's only one option. And then this guy could say talk to this guy. And this guy could talk to this guy. So that's one graph I could do. But there are other graphs I could do. Because I could do something where, say, this guy connects to this guy to this guy, but then here it's more connected. This guy to this one, and this guy to this one. So this graph here would be kind of a disconnected graph. And this thing here would be more connected graph. Okay, this one would be connected. And finally, there would be also the possibility of drawing something like this. I'll have double line notation to indicate lines of type 2. And then here, one could talk to one as well. Right? And I have a. And this would be really the most connected one of all. Now, this separation was a bit artificial because I could just think of this as a single big vertex with many edges. But that's because single integrals are like zero-dimensional quantum field theory. There is no space-time, so there are no labels. And therefore, because there are zero-dimensional space-times, all points are on top of each other, and I cannot separate the vertices. But more realistically, these x's would come with an extra label of position or momentum or whatever, and then bringing down twice, it's really a product of two vertices. Okay? And we can see that in a moment when we will do the computation of the propagator with our mu. And you see, if you wanted to check how many terms there are, so in this language, when you compute this expectation value, you can easily count how many graphs there are, because one, the first x1 can couple with any of the other three. The first x2 can couple to any of the other three x2. So there are in total 3 times 3 options. So this computation here gives 3 times 3 times the propagators, which is just 1 over alpha to the power 4, which is the number of propagators. Do you agree? This is just from choosing how many choices there are. So I have x1, 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 x1. The first x1 has 3 options, and then the other 2 need to be coupled. And then I go to x2. I have x2, 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 x2. The first x2 has 3 options, and then the other x2 are automatically chosen. So it's 3 times 3 times 1 over alpha to the 4, so it's 9 in total. So this, the result should be 9 over alpha squared. Over alpha to the 4. Okay. And let's see how that would come about, hopefully, from the graphs I drew here. So here there is one graph where I connect this, and I connect this, I connect this, and I connect this. So here, this is a single graph, one. Okay. Here, I drew this graph, where these guys get connected, these guys get connected. But here, I could connect to this leg or to the other leg, and I would draw it in the same way. Right? There would be no difference. So here, there would be a factor of 2 from choosing this is A, this is A prime. I could choose who is A and who is A prime. So fixing a leg A, there would be 2 options for A prime. And here, there would be 4 options, because I choose again A, A prime, B, B prime. And finally, there is one graph that I forgot, which is the analog of this, with the bubbles up here, right? So let's write here plus 2, where we put the bubbles upstairs. And 1 plus 2 plus 2 plus 4 is equal to 9. So here it was a bit, it was my choice. I could choose, and I chose, right, as 2 vertices. And then I need to be careful with the counting of graphs when I separate into 2 vertices. And I'm careful now. I see 1 plus 2 plus 2 plus 4, and that's precisely 9. That's how we would reproduce in a graphical way a result that I could just compute very easily. But, mathematically, right? So that's how the 9 is easily reproduced. Yeah. Okay, good. So next time, what we will do is now apply this general idea to our case, where we are exactly now we have not 2 modes, but we have all the Fourier modes. And then we have the x to the 4 that is exactly coupling the modes. And we could ask, what's the first correction? The first correction is the analog of this first term. So this first term would give something like a bubble diagram like this. And that would be the bubble diagram that would correct, say, the partition function of our table due to the effect of this nonlinearity. Okay? And we could also start correcting the propagator through the effect of this nonlinearity. And that's also what we are going to do. Okay. So next time, I'll start the lecture by just finishing the computation of the effect of mu treated as a small parameter, generalizing these Friedmann graphs to the case of our table, which is more already like a statistical field theory. Okay. In the wiki, there are some papers that you might want to have a look at the general introduction of these papers. So it's about papers about this quantum thermalization. I don't know if you had time to give them a quick look. They are already in the wiki, right, Lauren? Yeah, okay. That is what we are going to do. That will be the plan for tomorrow. Okay, thank you.